From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Thomas Edison said genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. Does that mean anyone can become a genius if they just work hard enough? In this hour, the path to greatness, practical tips on how to cultivate your hidden talents, and we'll meet four people who just got the call of a lifetime, a MacArthur Genius Grant, one of the most coveted awards in the world. Recipients get a six-figure cash prize, no strings attached. On the list this year, concert pianist Jeremy Denk, jazz musician Vijay Iyer, astrophysicist Sarah Seeger, and 32-year-old fiction writer Karen Russell.
Karen Russell, congratulations on winning a MacArthur Genius Award.
Oh, Anne, thank you so much. Yeah, I'm thrilled. I'm disbelieving and thrilled.
When and where and how did you get the news?
I had recently moved to this studio sublet in Brooklyn. I think I was standing in this foreign kitchen, and appropriately, it's right at twilight, so it was already kind of a Twilight Zone sort of setting. And I have been dealing with car insurance. So this voicemail was from a woman named Cecilia. I'd been talking to Monica in Texas about the car, so I was like, oh, I see my case has been transferred to this kind-sounding person named Cecilia. And they asked me if I was familiar with the MacArthur Grant, and I believe it was that moment where some sort of dissociative event happened. Part of me floated far outside of time.
Well, so the MacArthur Award famously comes with a whopping big monetary prize. I don't remember, how much is it?
I'm afraid to say it. I'm a superstitious thinker, Anne. It's $600,000.
What will that mean to you practically? I mean, are there things you'll be able to do that you wouldn't even have contemplated before?
Certainly, you know, one thing that immediately occurred to me was I love writing short stories, and short stories are incredibly labor-intensive for me and time-consuming. Sometimes I'll gestate one for a calendar year. Sometimes I'll feel guilty working on them, right, because you just know that you'll have to figure out something else to do to fill in
to pay the bills.
Income, right, to fill in income. So I think to have that scaffolding in place makes all kinds of new things possible.
Mm-hmm. Your first reactions must have been ecstatic and overjoyed. And I'm curious, as the news sank in a bit, you know, a day or so later,
right,
what other kinds of thoughts and feelings did you start to notice?
Just incredible gratitude, unlike anything I've experienced. I go into these fugues of gratitude now. You know, I called my old freshman writing seminar professor. I'm like drafting these long emails because I think it makes you aware of how much luck preceded it, how many things had to go right to get to a place where something like this is possible, and how many people sort of help you along the way and have provided support and been mentors. Back in the dark ages, where it was just not obvious that I would ever publish anything.
Mm. So. What do you think about that label, genius? What does it feel like to be publicly labeled a genius?
Oh, no, no. Well, I think to put the frame genius around it, my impulse immediately is to use deprecation as some kind of tool to put air holes in the box. And it's funny, the genius label got appended by journalists. Did you know this? The actual foundation doesn't use that word because they say in some ways it's too narrow. It connotes a kind of intellectual prowess, you know, like a high IQ prowess, and they sort of have a range of, you know, this thing has gone to farmers and nurse practitioners, and I think it's nice because it makes me feel like I'm off the hook a little bit. My siblings kind of kept me grounded by listing every dumb thing I've ever said and done immediately after I told them. So, you know, they were my friend Vince, too, he was like, wow, you didn't understand how the Brita works. My friend Carrie was reminding me about how I never know which toothbrush is my own. You know, so it's nice to also feel like you're just a human in a body doing your best. And, yeah, sort of incredible things can happen. And I always think it's persistence more than anything else, right? I mean, I think it's just sort of, if I had listened every time that I thought a draft was doomed, I wouldn't have published anything.
Well, congratulations again from all your fans. You
thank you,
absolutely
Anne.
Deserve it.
Thank you, guys.
Karen Russell is famous for her remarkable blend of fantasy and realism, which was on full display in her recent short story collection, Vampires in the Lemon Grove. Earlier this year, Anne Strangechamps talked with Karen about the book and the art of writing short stories. The title story is about a vampire couple who've discovered they don't need to drink blood to survive, though they have an endless craving for it. It turns out they can get a temporary fix from lemon juice.
Over the years, McGreb and I have tried everything. Fangs in apples, fangs in rubber balls. We have lived everywhere. Tunis, Laos, Cincinnati, Salamanca. We spent our honeymoon hopping continents, hunting liquid chimeras, mint tea in Fez, coconut slurries in Oahu, jet black coffee in Bogota, jackal's milk in Dakar, cherry coke floats in rural Alabama, 1,000 beverages purported to have magical quenching properties. We went thirsty in every region of the globe before finding our oasis here in the blue boot of Italy at this dead nun's lemonade stand. It's only these lemons that give us any relief. When we first landed in Sorrento, I was skeptical. The pitcher of lemonade we ordered looked cloudy and adulterated, sugar clumped at the bottom. I took a gulp, and a whole small lemon lodged in my mouth. There is no word sufficiently lovely for that first taste, the first feeling of my fangs in that lemon. After an initial prickling, a sort of chemical effervescence along my gums, a soothing blankness traveled from the tip of each fang to my fevered brain. These lemons are a vampire's analgesic. If you have been thirsty for a long time, if you have been suffering, then the absence of those two feelings, however brief, becomes a kind of heaven.
Karen, the short stories in this new collection, I read one description of them as the perfect blend of magic and reality. How does that description strike you?
Oh, my goodness. The bar is high if you're saying perfect blend, right? I do like that. I like that it's some kind of Starbucks blend of magic and reality. I've sort of always been drawn as a reader to fiction where it's happening on a continuum, right? It gets really slippery. Whatever distinction between the real world and the imaginary one, it gets effaced. And I grew up in South Florida, right? I think the last time I was on the show, I was talking about Florida, which is like a magical realist state.
Really? I was going to say a lot of people would think of that as the least magical place in America.
Well, that's probably true, too. But I think it was such a good instruction for a would-be fiction writer because you have all of these invented places, you know, theme parks, tiny diorama universes. In principle, anyway, Florida's big industry is fantasy. And then you have just the real strangeness of the geography, the ocean, the Everglades, and also just people living their real lives in this kind of surreal place. So I'm sure that whenever I talk about sort of fantasy and reality, I think about just my childhood home where it was anybody's guess where one line ended and the other began.
Boy, that is such a natural segue into the second story in this book, which I have to say did stay with me for a very long time. And word to readers, don't read this one before bed. This is the one about the girls who sort of turn into silkworms.
Yeah, that is probably the most upsetting one in some ways.
What happens in it?
It's set during Meiji era Japan. The sort of historical bedrock for it is just there was this period of incredibly rapid industrialization where Japan is going from this isolated feudal nation to sort of its modern form. And then in a micro way, I was reading about the story of these daughters of tenant farmers who went to work as silk reelers in these new Western-style textile mills. And they were promised a really pretty glamorous and well-compensated life as sort of cotton spinners, silk reelers. In many cases, the actual history is pretty devastating. They are working 10-hour shifts in terrible conditions. So anyway, this is a very long wind-up, but the story ended up being about these daughters of farmers who are duped into going to work at a place called Nowhere Mill, a really nightmarish factory, and transformed into actual silkworms. So they're kind of compulsively producing silk.
Is there a bit of it you could read for us?
Yeah, let me do maybe just the, I'll put it bluntly paragraph, because
yeah,
that's sort of how gross it becomes. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll put it bluntly. We are all becoming reelers, some kind of hybrid creature, part kaiko, silkworm caterpillar, and part human female. Some of the older workers' faces are already quite covered with a coarse white fur, but my face and thighs stayed smooth for 20 days. In fact, I've only just begun to grow the white hair on my belly. During my first nights and days in this silk reeling factory, I was always shaking. I have never been a hysterical person, and so at first I misread these tremors as mere mood. I was in the clutches of a giddy sort of terror, I thought. Then the roiling feeling became solid. It was the thread, a color purling invisibly in my belly. Silk. Yards and yards of thin color would soon be extracted from me by the machine.
That's so hideous and beautiful all at the same time. And you know what's so effective about that is that it is both fantastical and grounded at the same time. And the details are so concrete. Is that a very deliberate choice you make, kind of a way of making, I guess, the supernatural real?
You know, I do think so. And I think I've learned so much by osmosis, because this was the stuff I love to read. People like Frank Herbert and Dune, or, Calvino and Borges, or Kafka, certainly. So The Metamorphosis is such a great example of precise physical detail. I mean, it's scary and funny in a range of emotions when Gregor Samsa wakes up in that insect body. And I think, he doesn't stop there. I mean, he's imagining, how would this really feel? What do his little legs look like twittering out of the corner of his new bug eyes? What does it feel like to have a hard shell back? What are you going to do when you're both worried that you're going to be late for work and you can't roll over on your exoskeleton and climb out of bed because you're a cockroach? So I was reading stuff where there's no switch and register. It's very matter of fact. The table and the bed and the picture frame are described in the same kind of detail as Gregor Samsa's new mandibles. For me, too, I think it wasn't such a stretch to sort of imagine and to make concrete this silk growing inside these girls. In this story, it's really connected sort of to their memories and their emotional worlds. I think a lot of people have that, right, where an emotion feels like a concrete entity. It feels material, like grief can feel like a rock in your gut. So it is. I just think it's sort of a natural way for me to think about the materiality of emotions in the past, too, mm-hmm. Just the weight they can carry.
Karen Russell is a novelist and short story writer, and a recipient of a 2013 MacArthur Fellowship, the Genius Award. She talked with N. Strainchamps about her short story collection, Vampires in the Lemon Grove. Who doesn't dream of being a genius? Or maybe even better, the parent of a genius. Truth is, just about every parent has had the experience of, sitting at a piano recital or a soccer game, feeling secretly thrilled by their child's performance. Until that kid shows up. You know which one. The one who plays a Beethoven sonata flawlessly from memory at age 8. Or looks like a baby Beckham or a Mia Hamm on the soccer field.
We've all had that experience of seeing people who seemed especially good at an early age.
Jeffrey Colvin's the author of the book Talent is Overrated. Those kids at the piano recital, Colvin says it's too soon to tell if they have what it takes to be a genius.
Here's the trouble. What the research shows is that you can't tell. And in fact, there has been work on piano players as kids. And one of the things it found was that if you looked at those who became really great, and by that I mean those who were in the world-class piano competitions, the Van Cliburn or the Leventritt, the top global piano competitions, if you looked at them back when they were, say, 11 years old, on average they had been taking piano lessons by that time for 5 or 6 years, and you would suppose if they had this incredible natural ability, you would certainly have seen it after 5 or 6 years of training. But no one could have predicted at the age of 11 or 12 who the great ones were going to be.
Now, if you're like me, you're listening to this and thinking, what about Mozart or Tiger Woods? History's full of people who were truly, undeniably great. From day one.
Yes, we often feel that Mozart was an incredible genius, but here's the thing to remember. He was receiving intensive training for hours a day from an excellent teacher whom he lived with every day from the age of 4. He didn't go to school like other kids. He was trained at home by his father to become a great musician for hours and hours a day. In other words, Mozart, far from contradicting the thesis about where great performance comes from, seems to be a perfect example of it.
I think we tend to look at our heroes, Michael Jordan, Mozart, Darwin, and think, oh, they just popped out as geniuses. That's not true.
Carol Dweck is a psychologist at Stanford University. She spent years trying to figure out the secrets of success. By now, we've all heard the famous recipe, 10,000 hours. That's how much practice it takes to get really good at something, maybe even world-class good. But Dweck says that's not quite right. It's not just 10,000 hours of practice you need. It's a specific kind of practice.
You can hardly find anyone who made a great creative contribution without years of overcoming adversity and setbacks. Anyone who gets to be called a genius is usually someone who, not someone who wasn't talented. Sure, they were talented, but they took their talent somewhere with their passionate dedication. They pushed out of their comfort zone. It's something that psychologists call deliberate practice, constantly pushing out of your comfort zone.
The term deliberate practice is very specific. What it means is you always have to be pushed just beyond what you can currently do. Now, that means you're doing things that you don't quite know how to do, and that means you will fail. You will make mistakes. It will be painful. It won't be a lot of fun. You won't have the great satisfaction of watching that shot that you know how to hit, you know, fly beautifully into the air. You'll constantly be making mistakes.
Takes a lot of fortitude to make yourself practice like that. So maybe geniuses are people with a talent for making themselves fail over and over again. Carol Dweck says there's something in that, but the trick is to learn how not to cringe at failure, which turns out to be a teachable skill. At Stanford, she and her team run workshops in which they teach children how to fail.
What we have found is that praising your child's intelligence is bad. It backfires. It makes the children not want challenging tasks they could learn from. They don't want to make a mistake. They don't want to look bad. So what do we do instead? My research shows praise the process the child engaged in. Effort, strategy, taking on hard tasks, persisting in the face of obstacles. And when we do that, the children learn a growth mindset, they enjoy difficulty, and they keep on going.
So if you were talking to a parent of a young child on how to equip their kid for success, what's the first order of business? What do you say to them?
I'd say stop telling your child he or she is brilliant or talented. Make sure they are challenged all the time and that they love challenge. They see challenge as fun. Teach them how to persist on tasks. Boy, that's an interesting mistake. Really interesting. Where should we go now? Teach them to generate new strategies in the face of setbacks.
So in some ways, we should promote failure.
Yes, but within a growth mindset.
Meanwhile, Jeffrey Colvin has one more piece of advice for young people, or parents, dreaming of greatness.
Find what you're passionate about. And the reason is, great performance, as we've said, comes from constantly pushing yourself, typically for hours a day, every single day. The only way you're going to do that is if somehow you have an internal feeling. You have a passion, a drive that comes from inside you. Ultimately, there is no external reward that is going to be sufficient. So the old advice to follow your passion, do what you love, is very sound advice. Now, most kids don't even know what their passion is early. That's fine, as long as they're focused on finding it.
That's Jeffrey Colvin. We also heard from Carol Dweck on what makes a genius.
I had a dream that I fathered a bizarro genius, baby. She's out the womb like,
dude, why did I get expatriated?
Debated it 1 month, the finer points of a diaper. Devised a device composed of a hose and a windshield wiper. Grew riper and intellect as the months passed. Wore a dunce cap, ironically. Grew fussy once and she summoned me, not sonically, but through a series of editorials that she authored. Entitled, this MC from the lot, one of the worst fathers. Oxford, Stanford, Harvard called, shouldn't call him back.
Tuition and housing, I'm holding out for a danger.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking today with a few geniuses, or at least some of the people who just won MacArthur Genius Awards. Concert pianist Jeremy Denk is one of this year's recipients. He recently stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson.
Jeremy, you are not only a celebrated pianist, you also have a wonderful gift for writing music in your blog, Think Denk, in various essays you've done for The New Yorker and other places. Is the writing just a fun extra for you, or is it fundamental?
It's hard to say. It started as a kind of accident, but I think it turned into something a little more fundamental. Sometimes in some cases, you know, I'll write an essay on the blog, for example, about a piece that I'm playing, and it will crystallize something about the piece that I sort of knew, but only when I had to put it in a paragraph form that it finally become more real or more truthful. And then I would go back to the piano and play it more like my blog, which is odd. But I think for the most part, the writing is sort of an offshoot of the way that I'd like to approach musical interpretation generally, which is with a lot of association, hopefully with a lot of imagination and surprise, and I guess humor also is a key recurring element of the blog
which is partly what makes it so fun to read.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah, that's. I mean, I think that humor is a sort of underappreciated and underdiscussed element in much great classical music. A lot of Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, you know, the big three guys that are the sort of defining classical style. Their style is basically built on the style of comic opera, the sort of rhythm of comic opera, which is the quick juxtaposition of seeming opposites. Just like a regular, like a comedian these days would, you mash up two unlikely things.
Well, your recent album pairs the music of Ligeti's Etudes with the last Beethoven sonata. So a 20th century composer with an early 19th century composer. What's the connection between the two?
Well, You probably realize that I wrote a little bit ad nauseum about the possible connections in
the
liner.
You have very extensive liner notes, yes, which are a joy to read.
Well, it's, you know, I guess extenuation and infinity and the possibilities of things basically on the edge. 111 was Beethoven's last sonata. He kind of plunges off the cliff of the past into the future in that sonata in a very profound way. And in two movements, sort of one backward-looking and the second endlessly forward-looking.
It has a very modern sound.
That's right. And I guess that's the essence of the juxtaposition is Beethoven creates a kind of huge journey to infinity in that last sonata. And Ligeti, all these little etudes of his, each of them is like a little bite-sized nugget of infinity. He's very obsessed with these fractals and the possibilities of simple ideas turned into impossibly complex formations.
You have wonderful things to say about the whole business of playing piano etudes. You say there's nothing more perverse than that, given all the possible finger contortions.
Well, anyone who's studied the piano even mildly seriously knows that there are these sort of so-called piano exercises, which are more like torture instruments. Building the muscle mechanisms you need to play the piano well involves these sort of Czerny or Hannon. And Ligeti sort of takes that and he runs with it, and often in very funny ways makes that kind of exercise like eight times harder because he adds another, you know, mind-bending element to it.
Well, give me an example of that.
Well, even the first etude, which I think is it's only 2.5 minutes long, and I must have spent 300 or 400 hours of my life trying to get it under my fingers. You you know, it's a rhythmic pattern which begins with both hands together. It's sort of threes and fives. And you play it, and then very shortly into it, the left hand gets one note behind, as if you were a kind of a terrible pianist. He gets one beat further behind and ever further behind them.
So you almost have to think with the two hands separately.
Oh, yes, you do. I mean, it's like, and that of course, is this thing that you do in sort of normal piano exercises all the time. You try to build the sort of independence of the hands, but Ligeti sort of places all that on steroids and goes ape on it.
This technical challenge, don't you? I mean, that's my sense, is you're kind of drawn to the sheer demands of virtuosity in some cases.
I guess that I am, which is I have often come to regret in one way or another. But you know, I'm drawn to pieces that are on the edge, and I always thought these Ligeti etudes, you know, and I think a lot of pianists feel this way too. And these pieces are among the greatest things written for the piano recently. And so I was drawn to the music. Unfortunately, the music is the hardest thing, like, ever written, basically. But I just really like it. And there's the element of the demonic, the element of the things that are out of control. But it's also that it makes the piano sound fantastic.
You know what, I love the way you talk about music, and also the way you write about it, is I get the sense you're almost talking back to the composer. I mean, you're kind of having a little argument about the pieces you're playing, and, you know, there's sort of a quarrel there, but obviously a deep love as well.
Right. Yeah, I guess I like to complain about when composers make your life miserable, even though it's, you know, my own choice to play these particular pieces. I guess, you know, Beethoven, Mozart, Schumann, I mean, all these people are in a way my best friends, because I spend more time with them than almost anyone else. Inevitably, you develop these kind of fraught feelings about them and their music that is a lot like your relationship with your friends.
What I found so fascinating about reading about your history of learning to play and working with various piano teachers is the disciplinary rigor involved. And, I mean, the way you write about it, I mean, there's a fair amount of suffering.
Yes.
In that process, but I have the sense that there's something you crave about the suffering. You know, the more it hurts, the better you will play.
Well, there is, I mean, like any, let's say, athlete training, there is something about no pain, no gain. And there are muscles involved, and they need to be calibrated. And there's so many things that pianists have to build in order to be able to play, to be able to translate their idea of music.
I want to ask you about Szabák, your teacher, after you graduated from Oberlin, this Hungarian pianist. What did you learn from him?
Well, it's kind of impossible to sum up, you know, what I learned from him. I mean, in a way, it was like a whole European worldview, a whole different ethos of what music was for and what performing was for. He had this feeling of being a guru, and you felt that the whole practice of playing the piano, after all the exercises and all the juries and the auditions and the competitions and the ratings, that suddenly that playing the piano became sort of a sacred space again. He was very obsessed with finding the truthfulness of each phrase. It's kind of a dangerous word in a way, but I never forget the way he talked about the opening theme of the last movement, kind of what many people might think is a sort of dopey theme of the last movement of this Mozart concerto. And it's a sort of a sing-songy theme. And he showed how each bar of it had a slightly different rhythmic grouping. So that in place of this sort of lump of four bars of dopey theme, you had suddenly an incredible play between rhythmic possibilities. Maybe that's, if I had to sum up, you know, the things that he taught me, that's one of the big ones.
Well, you also write about one particular moment. I think it was early in your work with Szabák. I think maybe you were in a master's class playing, was it a Brahms concerto? And he asked you to play a particularly difficult passage with your eyes closed.
Indeed.
Can you describe what happened?
it's a big entrance sort of near the beginning of the piece, and I played with this sort of caution and looking at all the notes and making sure. And I, of course, the more that I looked to make sure, the more notes that I missed or the more unconvincing it was musically. And he made me shut my eyes in front of all these people, all the faculty, and imagine in my brain the sort of area of the keyboard that I had to hit. Sort of imagine the F, which was the main note, but also the E next to it and the G flat just above it, the sort of whole topography of the keyboard over there. And he was like, his point was that I knew the piano subconsciously better than I realized. And that rang so true to me when he said that, that I knew that I had hours and so many hours of knowledge. It was like a trust exercise, a musical trust exercise. And this is how I want my piano playing to be. I want it to be trusting and not inimical to the keyboard, but in a way, in very loving relationship to it. So I went to study with him.
Hmm. So nowadays, how much do you practice on an average day?
It really depends on the extent to which I'm cramming or preparing for something. But I actually went through a period in November and December where I decided to only practice 2 or so hours a day and no more, because I felt that somehow I was getting diminishing returns. And indeed, in that period of practicing a little bit less, I felt that my music making was opening up a little bit. If you can really accomplish one thing, one discovery or one improvement in a day of practice, that's quite a lot, in my opinion.
Are you a perfectionist?
Yes, I am, unfortunately.
Do you have to be a perfectionist to be a really good concert pianist?
Of course. It's very demanding and it's very meticulous. There's also other things that go into it. Imagination, obviously, and love for the music. And those things help to make all the other parts more bearable.
Jeremy Denk is a concert pianist, a blogger, and a recipient of a 2013 MacArthur Fellowship, the Genius Award. He spoke with Steve Paulson. What's the difference between a good artist and a great one? Graphic artist Austin Kleon likes to quote T.S. Eliot, "Good artists copy, great artists steal."
I was shocked myself to find out how many artists really use that term, stealing. And it's not just artists, it's people of all fields. Someone like Steve Jobs or Kobe Bryant, he talks about stealing basketball moves when he was watching tapes when he was young. Someone like Francis Ford Coppola will say, you steal when you're younger, and then you add something new to the pot, and then pretty soon people are stealing from you. The whole concept of originality is kind of an invention of the 19th century. We really don't have this idea of a lone creative genius until the Romanticists really come along. Before someone had a genius or they had geniuses that kind of like guided their lives. But then when Romanticism comes around, we have this idea that there's like this person that's kind of ordained by the gods with this unique creative ability. Actually, nothing comes from nowhere. All these creative geniuses that we think of, they were all thieves and they all borrowed liberally and they took things and they reworked them, and their genius, if you can call it that, is actually the way that they take their influences and gave us something new. What happens is after you start gathering your influences, then you start copying. We're talking about learning the moves. As you try to copy these heroes, you start realizing that you're not quite built like them. You have to make adjustments. You start combining them. You take something from one hero and you take something from the other, and pretty soon you have this kind of Frankenstein monster of your work. And then part of your job is to start transforming that monster into something smooth, something that kind of stands on its own. My big thing that I tell young artists is that you are a mashup of what you let into your life. And that actually comes from something my mother used to say to me, which used to drive me insane. She used to say, garbage in and garbage out.
Love.
there's a DJ named DJ Spooky, and he says, as a DJ, you're only going to be as good as your record collection. So what that means is, as an artist or a young artist, you're only going to be as good as the stuff you're surrounding yourself with. And that includes not only the books you read, the art you look at, your teachers, but it also includes your environment, where you choose to live, your friends. It's everything. You're literally a mashup of what you let into your life.
Austin Kleon is a writer and artist living in Austin, Texas. He's the author of Newspaper Blackout and Steal Like an Artist. Did you recognize some of those cuts? There were dozens of them, from classical music to jazz to hip-hop. The list, well, it's too long to read here. But we have videos of lots of them on our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking with some of the recipients of this year's MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Award. Sarah Seeger is the one astrobiologist on the list. A planetary scientist at MIT, she studies exoplanets, planets that orbit stars other than our sun. In the last few years, astronomers have found hundreds of them. Seeger is searching for biosignatures, evidence of life on another planet. Steve Paulson asked how she'll find it.
We're going to find it by what we call remote sensing. We will use space telescopes to look at atmospheres of other planets beyond our solar system. And in those atmospheres are gases. So our goal is to find out which gases are in an exoplanet atmosphere. On our own planet, some of the gases in our atmosphere are produced by life. And we'll hope to be able to attribute some gases on another planet to life. When can this happen? In the most optimistic view, if we are really lucky and planets that can support life are everywhere, and the ones that do support life generates a signature we can detect, then we may be able to find signs of life on an exoplanet before this decade is out.
So when you say a gas you don't expect, explain that. So what are the gases that you would expect from a lifeless planet, and what might be the unexpected gases?
The best example we have is our own atmosphere, Earth, where we have oxygen that fills our atmosphere to 20% by volume. 20%, that's a large fraction for a gas that, if we didn't have plants and other photosynthetic life, should be minuscule, almost undetectable.
So really, the only way you can explain so much oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere is that there is this life on the surface, and it is excreting oxygen, I guess you would say.
Yes, our life on our planet is excreting oxygen.
Now, you mentioned methane as another unusual gas. Why would methane be found?
Well, methane on our own planet is produced by some bacteria called methanogens. And these methanogens live in environments without oxygen. They take hydrogen, that's molecular hydrogen, and carbon dioxide. And they actually extract energy from the reaction between hydrogen and carbon dioxide. And one of the byproduct gases, you would call it excreted gas, is methane. And it is a sign of life. But let's actually take a bigger look for a second. One thing I love to hate is a terracentrism. We're great at coming up with what life does on Earth and thinking about other planets that way. We're not so good at coming up gases that don't belong, that are not already attributed to life on Earth.
Now, I suppose one of the great mysteries here, which gets to the central question of whether there is life elsewhere, is that we still don't have a clue how life originally started on Earth. I mean, how did we get from non-life to life? How did those non-life particles turn into the first living cells? Is that a basic stumbling block?
This is one of the biggest questions of all time. However, as an astrophysicist, I get to just forget about that question because it's really great. What we do is we don't worry about how life came to be. We don't worry about what life is. We just focus on what life does. And life on our own Earth puts out chemical byproducts, some of which will go into the atmosphere in enough quantity to be detectable remotely. So we focus in the search for exoplanets and the search for remote signs of life on what life does. Life metabolizes, life puts out gases. Some of those gases are biosignatures.
So it sounds like your educated guess is that there is probably a lot of life elsewhere, because it would seem that there would be these kinds of planets that would be conducive to life.
Let's put it this way. In our own galaxy alone, there are 100 billion stars. In our own universe, we believe there are upwards of 100 billion galaxies. And planets are everywhere. The chance that life has evolved on another planet somewhere else has to be 100%.
Wow. Okay. 100%. So you're sure there is life elsewhere?
I'm sure there is life. There are 100 billion stars. There are 100 billion galaxies.
How many planets have we found so far that would seem to be Earth-like planets?
As of yet, we have no truly Earth-like planets. I want you to understand how hard it is to find an Earth. Earth is so small, so dim, and so less massive than our sun that it's extremely difficult to detect Earth. Most of the planets that have been found so far are either much closer to their star than Earth is to its sun, or much bigger than Earth. Hmm. But we're on the verge. You know, every year, more and more planets are found of smaller and smaller size or smaller and smaller mass. So we're pushing down. We're working hard. It's like an archaeological dig. You go deeper and deeper, but we're pushing the planet-finding techniques to more and higher precision. So it's really just a matter of time before we find those Earth-size or Earth-mass planets out there.
Now, I could imagine that you might have two very different reactions to the discovery of life on another planet. Let's just sort of, for the sake of argument here, say that, you know, if you are 95% sure or 99% sure that there is life there, on the one hand, I'm sure you would be ecstatic to find such evidence. And yet, I would think you might also be very frustrated, because could you ever actually figure out what kind of life that might be?
We're getting into a generational question here. We're just starting out on a very, very long journey for humanity. The goal of my generation is to first find out whether or not Earth-like planets exist and whether or not they are common. We hope to be able to find signs of life and identify them. We will have to leave it to future generations, perhaps hundreds of years from now, who will find out whether or not life is really there. And the only way to be sure is to send a probe, that is a spacecraft, out to another star system and to look more closely at that planet.
But that would take years and years to send a probe all the way to another planet in another solar system, wouldn't it?
It would take years and years. But what is so fascinating is that for the first time, a group of people got together to discuss this question seriously. I have a series of questions I get asked most often from people of every kind of walk of life: children, other professors, other scientists, people I meet on the airplane, journalists. And out of those questions, the one I get asked most often is, can we go there? And no matter how carefully I explain that we have no way to go to another planet beyond our solar system now, I'll still get asked it again and again and again.
Okay, and I'm
and
another
one this,
asking that
well,
question.
I take this as a sign that our deep desire to travel in space will someday be realized. So DARPA, a government agency, has sponsored concept studies in how would we do this. And right now, the most bold engineers think there is a way to go, would be a way to eventually get to 10% the speed of light or more. So if we imagine that Alpha Centauri, our nearest sun-like star system, has a planet like Earth, Alpha Centauri is about 4.2 light years away. If you could travel at a tenth the speed of light, that's 40 years. You can imagine for a future generation, that's not that long. I mean, someone can launch a probe, and then 40 years later, we'll get information. And to answer one of the most important questions that has ever come across humanity, it's not that long to wait.
Sarah Seeger is an astrophysicist and planetary scientist at MIT and a 2013 MacArthur Fellow. She spoke with Steve Paulson. Now, the tunes of another MacArthur winner. You're listening to jazz pianist Vijay Iyer, one of the rising stars of the jazz world. He's released three critically acclaimed albums in the last 3 years. One of the remarkable things about Iyer is his background. He's Indian by heritage, and one of his projects is to create a new kind of music, a synthesis of Western jazz and Indian music. Iyer originally intended to go into science, not music. He has a PhD in physics and a deep understanding of both math and neuroscience, all of which he uses to make jazz. For example, he's even based some of his compositions on one of mathematics' most famous series of numbers,
the Fibonacci sequence. And Strangechamps asked Iyer how he's managed to meld his science with his art.
Well, what happened was after Yale, I did my undergraduate in math and physics at Yale, and then I entered the PhD program at UC Berkeley in physics. But at the same time, I'd been playing music all along. And in fact, in college, I had started writing my own music and leading my own bands and stuff. Then when I got to the Bay Area, I was suddenly kind of immersed in a musical culture. You know, I basically apprenticed with a lot of elder musicians. And so I was doing that while I was in a PhD program in physics, you know. But then what I ended up doing was instead of completely abandoning academia, I was able to put together my own interdisciplinary PhD program at UC Berkeley. And I ended up doing a dissertation on music perception and cognition. So basically the science of music, not quite the physics or math of music, but more the cognitive science of music. You know, it's basically the study of the mind and the brain and everything in between. A lot of that work kind of happened in a disembodied fashion, meaning that mental processes took place somewhere besides the body, you know?
As though the body was this giant machine you kind of tow around to,
yes.
to supply the energy to run the brain.
Yeah, and all that really mattered was what we did with our brains. So that's kind of this bias that's part of Western thought. It goes back to Descartes. Cartesian duality is called.
And I can see as a musician why this would interest you, because music is so physical. I mean, as a pianist, you must feel that when you're making music, you're not just using your head.
Well, what was important for me was thinking about rhythm, for example. Musical rhythm is essentially the rhythms of bodies in action.
Do you mean like the breath?
Well, breath is one inherent bodily rhythm that we have. Basically, breathing, walking, and talking all sort of take place on slightly different timescales. You know, the breath basically corresponds to the phrase, and walking basically corresponds to what we call pulse or beat. And talking corresponds to the stuff of music, the notes of music, the fine-grained detail in the music.
Is there a track from one of your recent CDs that you might point to illustrate some of what you're talking about?
Let me think. You know, you could listen to my version of Black and Tan Fantasy, which is a song by Duke Ellington. Basically, I'm kind of connecting with the history of stride piano, and you are responsible for multiple streams of activity. You have to, in the left hand, kind of generate a pulse and a sense of buoyancy and steadiness, and in the right hand, often sort of cut across that and be almost more conversational. It has to almost form sentences, I guess you could say that way. So it has to add up and make sense.
Getting back to that math degree of yours, you wrote a wonderful piece for The Guardian a year or so ago, How Fibonacci Taught Us to Swing.
that title was not my idea.
Oh, it's a great title. But what you say in the piece is, if I'm getting this right, you revealed that you actually use the Fibonacci sequence of numbers to structure some of your music.
Yeah, but I'm not the first to do that. You know, I can point you to other people who did that. Bartok, most famously. Coltrane, too.
So without going terribly heavily into the numbers, how does the Fibonacci sequence relate to your music?
Without going into numbers.
Well, we'll turn to the sum. I mean, the Fibonacci sequence is, it's you know, the famous 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8. It's basically each number in the sequence is the sum of the previous two numbers, right? And then it goes on forever.
It does, but what happens as you go further into forever, any pair of numbers in the sequence, if you divide one by the other, you get closer to this special ratio called the golden ratio, which is an irrational number, but it's a number that occurs all over the place in nature and in design and in architecture and in the growth of snail shells and sunflowers and all kinds of unlikely places. It basically represents growth.
Aesthetic beauty, doesn't it? Isn't that ratio behind a lot of things we find visually very beautiful?
That claim could be made. I guess what I'm trying to do is explore that. To what degree is that really true? You know, part of what I did, and particularly in that, what I talk about in that article, is an arrangement I did of this famous soul jazz song from the 70s called Mystic Brew by Ronnie Foster. But it has a particular harmonic rhythm that essentially is a Fibonacci rhythm. So then I wanted to see if I could test this and kind of take it through successive pairs of Fibonacci numbers. Play the same song, but through different Fibonacci derived versions of the song. That's probably the easiest. I don't know if that makes... It probably doesn't make any sense. But the point is not for it to make sense when I explain it, because, in fact, the musical result is the point.
It's fascinating because it sounds like you're using math to explore music. You start with math and say, well, let's see what might happen if we played around with this in musical terms.
I can see it working both ways, but I'm less interested in validating the sciences by making art that's in service of the sciences. I'm more interested in the sciences kind of serving art. You know, I think that all of my heroes, like Coltrane and like Thelonious Monk and Duke Ellington, they were onto all of this, all the stuff that we're talking about. They're basically on the frontiers of human perception, as far as I know. And yet they're using what they find in a creative way to make something that connects to us as humans.
Jazz pianist Vijay Iyer talked with Anne Strangechamps. He's a recipient of a 2013 MacArthur Genius Award. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Want to know the music we played or the books we talked about? You'll find a complete list on our website at ttbook.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The handle is @ttbook1. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Anne Strangechamps and Steve Paulson, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, Joe Hartke, and Stephanie Youngblood. Thanks to Ed Sterling for our listener theme, Remix. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.